Orb, Volume 1, Number 16, Civilization. Hello, welcome to The Orb. My name is Reed Hart. Civilization is one of those broad terms in English that can mean many things. Its origins from Latin combine the ideas of citizen and city. Only in the mid-18th century did it start its English use as an opposite of barbarism. The word has a meaning embracing the ideas of civil behavior, social order, and cultural sophistication. We're not primitives anymore. Civilization also implies a sense of motion, whereas civility is a more static term. For our purposes in this episode, I'm using it to broadly cover elements of the social, cultural, and economic collective people participate in for their mutual benefit, and the cooperative civil behavior needed to sustain that collective. More specifically, I'm going to talk about the properties that help create and shape civilization. After all, civilization is a very human creation. It is a soup created less by design than by stewing together the contributions of its constituents. Some ingredients are welcomed, and others shunned. People still have instincts from our hunter-gatherer origins. We recognize the value of binding together into tribes for safety and prosperity. We come to recognize our tribe members and can identify outsiders. In a world of limited resources, outsiders can be seen as a threat, and hostilities ensue. In some cases, outsiders can be seen as a resource. There were more than a few wars fought over access to women for labor and breeding. That barbaric past. We're ever so much more civilized now. Really?
Find me a primitive man built on a primitive plan. Someone with vigor and build. I don't mean the kind that belongs to a club, but a kind that has a club that belongs to him. I could be a personal slave of someone right out of a cave. The only man who'll ever win me has gotta wake up the gypsy in me. Find me a primitive man. Find me a primitive man.
We naturally build relationships with other people that are like us. This typically means race, creed, and cultural values. Referencing back to the past couple of episodes, individualism as a common value tends to manifest in countries with a widely diverse population. Where the population is racially and culturally mixed, or widely dispersed geographically, people tend to look after themselves as rugged individuals. Where countries have a mainly homogeneous population, socialist policy with strong social safety nets are more common. Collectivism, socialism, is better suited to countries that have a narrower vision of just who is one of us. David Abraham, an historian and legal scholar, gave a lecture at the American Academy in Berlin in May 2010, in which he suggested that the European welfare state is linked to ethnic homogeneity. People are more willing to share with those who seem like themselves. There is an inverse relationship, Abraham says, between the ease of access to membership and what that membership offers. For example, it has been easier to become a member of society in America, but there are fewer social benefits to doing so. Germany, on the other hand, offering a strong social safety net, has had a very rigorous process of entry to citizenship. Abraham notes that the subject is tied up with qualities of toleration, trust, and solidarity. Social constructs are not simply a matter of institutional implementation. Rather, a nation of compatriots grows organically and eventually forms the we that becomes a national identity, a we based on common histories and shared economic and social values. Combining toleration with trust to form solidarity does not come easily. There is something of a pendulum swinging between opposite ends of the spectrum. The United States began with a generally libertarian social philosophy and had a high tolerance for immigration and flexible labor markets. This has swung rather starkly to an exclusionary culture that rejects immigration now. Abraham wondered if the weak U.S. social safety net is a byproduct of American openness to immigration. You can come here, the message is, or was until recently, but you're on your own. The American columnist Kathy Pollitt suggests a more primitive theory. Quote, a critical mass of white Americans would rather not have something than see black and Latino Americans get it too, no matter how often progressives point out that most welfare mothers and most poor people are white. Big government means the hard-working white taxpayer heaping largesse on shiftless people of color. Unquote. This exclusion of the other was exemplified in France and Italy in the autumn of 2010 as they made world news for controversial efforts to expel their Roma populations. The gypsies have a cultural identity that has, it seems eternally, lacked the territory to form a nation. These are certainly not the first and will not be the last countries to select an identifiable group as being not us. So what forms civilization? Consider the civilizing action of the English as they extended their empire in India. There were thoughtful Englishmen that recognized that the people of India were a nation that needed to be sovereign. In July 1833, Thomas Babington Macaulay spoke in Parliament in England. Quote, are we to keep the people of India ignorant in order that we may keep them submissive? Or do we think that we can give them knowledge without awakening ambition? Or do we mean to awaken ambition and to provide it with no legitimate vent? Who will answer any of these questions in the affirmative? To trade with civilized men is infinitely more profitable than to govern savages. That would indeed be a doting wisdom, which, in order that India might remain a dependency, would make it a useless and costly dependency, which would keep 100 millions of men from being our customers in order that they might continue to be our slaves. Governments, like men, may buy existence too dear. To lose the reason for living for the sake of staying alive is a despicable policy both in individuals and in states. The mere existence of empire is not necessarily an advantage. To many governments it has been cumbersome, to some it has been fatal. It will be allowed by every statesman of our time that the prosperity of a community is made up of the prosperity of those who compose the community, and that it is the most childish ambition to covet dominion, which adds to no man's comfort or security. Unquote. Sovereign states are the result of a group of people self-identifying as us and seeking to improve their quality of life through joint effort. Ultimately, the goal of creating social bonds is to build strength and develop prosperity. The path to that prosperity varies dramatically, depending upon the creeds and cultures that form the glue. The individualist culture tends to emphasize competition as a major driver to prosperity and with it the self-sufficiency of profit. The collectivist prefers to channel the energy of the whole to create wealth, which is more broadly shared through social programs and supports. I don't wish to suggest our civilized world is so black and white. Each culture finds a balance that suits its temperament. Each country looks upon others and finds things to emulate and things to avoid. Both function on the basis that the people within share the values of their fellows. Judging one a success and another a failure is entirely a matter of the yardstick one uses. Some measure success by monetary wealth, others by social harmony. Prosperity is not just about material gain, it is also about living well, in peace, love, and joy. Civilization must be civil to successfully prosper. Determining whether they are prospering is something only the citizens themselves can judge. The people, collectively, as a society, set the expectations for what their society must do. It is when those expectations diverge from reality that there is bound to be trouble for those claiming to rule. In August 2011, Britain broke into 5 days of rioting. There is an argument to be made that this was the result of years of government policy shift from a collectivist, socialist alignment toward the individualism popular in America. The culture of the people had lagged behind the policy changes of government. Dr. Kwame Mackenzie, a Canadian psychiatrist born and raised in the UK, said, "It is about changing the relationship between government and the citizen. Essentially, they are rewriting the social contract so that people are more self-reliant and less reliant on government." The upheaval in Britain is linked to a culture of entitlement that had been part of the original social contract. People in the UK have a very set idea of what it is the state owes them, and changing from that is difficult. He describes three factors at play in the riots that arise from the rewritten social contract. The first is the breakdown in social cohesion, the glue that keeps people thinking about we rather than me, and stops people from looting your shop because it's part of the community and we're all in this together. Increasing income inequality over the past 30 years affected how people think about society and each other. Cohesion shifted from the integrated society as a whole and reverted to basics, as noted by Ian Johnson Cole, a Manchester shop owner. He describes what happened as he was shuttering his shop as trouble was just starting in Manchester.
So our shutter's not the best of shutters, so we were trying to pull it across, and then I had this black guy on a bike circle me a couple of times, and he just started laughing. And I just said to him, "What are you laughing about, mate?" And he's like, "You don't realise how lucky you are." And I was like, in what sense? He's like, "Well, because if you weren't black, I would have robbed you, your keys, and your store right now."
The second factor in the rioting was the government's austerity program. Until 1997, university education in Britain was free for everyone. In 1998, the government brought in fees of about $1,600 per year for tuition at the country's top universities. By 2012, that figure will be about $16,000. At the same time, the financial assistance given to needy students was eliminated, taking away that route out of poverty. The system used to be able to cater to the less well-educated with unskilled jobs that have now gone abroad. Governments are disengaging and leaving it to the market. But the market has a history of not bothering. As Mackenzie says, when the goods are dangled before them and then the means of accessing them are removed, that is dangerous. The third factor is the increasing feeling that the people have no voice in how their society is structured. People are being asked to move from a socialized tradition to a market economy where it is dog-eat-dog. Although the police are often the targets of violence in these riots, it is primarily because they are a symbol of the state that happens to be present in the streets. The British government response was to bring in an American anti-gang expert. British police branded the move misguided and an insult to their professionalism. The Metropolitan Police Federation spokesman Paul Deller said, "British officers police by consent, whereas American cops police by force." Bill Bratton, the expert brought in from New York, believes that it's better to have measures in place to get ahead of the violence rather than just react to it. Essentially, A government failing to meet the expectations of the people needs to compel its citizens by force to accept a culture the rulers want. This dissolves the tolerance, trust, and solidarity a society needs to remain civilized. Social cohesion must come from the people themselves. History is littered with totalitarian regimes that have fallen when the people reject the authorities and reclaim their power. Even the chief constable of the Greater Manchester Police, Peter Fahey, recognizes that police cannot contain a citizenry that rejects authority.
I totally support the courts, particularly the courts here in Manchester, have given long prison sentences to say, if you as an individual go out and shoplift, that's bad. But if you go out in a mob, that is something far more serious.
Why is that more serious? Actually?
Because it threatens society itself. It threatens society itself. You know, we've got to be honest, we're a thin blue line out there as police officers. The system will only work if the vast majority of people observe the law.
Naomi Klein notes there have been other mass lootings in recent years. There was Baghdad in the aftermath of the U.S. invasion, a frenzy of arson and looting that emptied factories, offices, libraries, and museums. Back then, the people on cable news thought looting was highly political. They said this is what happens when a regime has no legitimacy in the eyes of the people. After watching for so long as Saddam and his sons helped themselves to whatever and whomever they wanted, many regular Iraqis felt that they had earned the right to take a few things for themselves. But London isn't Baghdad, and British Prime Minister David Cameron is hardly Saddam, so surely there is nothing to learn here. How about an example from a democratic country? Argentina, 2001. The economy was in freefall, and thousands of people living in rough neighborhoods stormed foreign-owned superstores. They came out, pushing shopping carts overflowing with the goods they could no longer afford. Argentina's mass looting was called El Saqueo, the sacking. That was politically significant because it was the very same word used to describe what the country's elites had done by selling off the country's national assets in flagrantly corrupt privatization deals, hiding their money offshore, then passing on the bill to the people with a brutal austerity package. Argentines understood that the saqueo of the shopping centers would not have happened without the bigger saqueo of the country, and that the real gangsters were the ones in charge. But England is not Latin America, and its riots are not political, or so we are told. The Tories are right when they say the rioting is not about the cuts, but it has a great deal to do with what those cuts represent, being cut off. The cuts are a message. They are saying to whole sectors of society, you are stuck where you are, much like the migrants and refugees we turn away at our increasingly fortressed borders.
We want your information. We will do what we must. But not here or in front of people or on the farm. We're not all blood-sucking leeches, for we all have families too. But that don't mean that we really love them, or that we don't. 'Cause I can't love you, and you can't love me. But I can love you, and you can love me. Love.
expect to hand out so many things. Some can help you, and you can help me, but I can't help you, and you can't help me. I can help you, you can help me. I can help you, you can help me.
Help me. We can do this, but I can't help you.
In January 1848, Abraham Lincoln wrote, "Any people anywhere, being inclined and having the power, have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable, a most sacred right, a right which we hope and believe is to liberate the world." A Facebook acquaintance of mine, Richard Kobelt, wrote, quote, "Behind every smashed window is a thousand tears. Behind every burning car is someone crying out in agony. Behind every criminal action is someone who has received the short stick of gross inequality. I am not elated by violence. I'm elated by change." Lincoln also said, "Die when I may. I want it said by those who knew me best that I always plucked a thistle and planted a flower where I thought a flower would grow." Kobelt went on, "Every day this deeply rooted thistle's grip is further loosened. Sometimes the spikes of the thistle sting us, and sometimes, when we have the opportunity and the insight, we remember to wear gloves. Sometimes our fields are so full of thistle that we can't grow any food, and we don't have any gloves, and we're starving. So we just need to start pulling. Violence is a sad and unfortunate byproduct. This pain is the breaking of the shell which encloses our understanding." Unquote. Values pursued in one society may not match those pursued in another. Neither is wrong, as long as none try to force one upon the other. Sadly, this arises most often when a ruling class tries to force differing values upon the people with whom they claim to share solidarity. Social solidarity is built from tolerance and trust. To be civil, we need to feel a connection to others. That connection cannot be forced upon us. Tolerance comes first from our hearts. To be civilized, we need to open our hearts to recognizing that everyone else is a person too. They have needs and wants, loves and fears, longing and aspirations. Trust that they are just like you. Tolerance opens a door to the other. Trust is built when that other shares their values with you. We are familiar with this in our personal relationships. People form family partnerships because we know that sharing the workload makes it lighter, and sharing the joys makes them richer. Sharing builds solidarity, and with it, civilization. Thank you. Orb operates exclusively on listener support. Please visit us at orbcast.ca and join in. There is a discussion forum and other premium content for members. If you have a topic you would like the Orb to focus on, please send an email to suggestions@orbcast.ca. You can write to me at host@orbcast.ca. I'm Reed Hart.